You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Okay, hello everyone, and welcome back to STEMcast. Today we are joined by Dr. Simon Lahou, a professor at John Abbott College. So, Simon, can you please tell us a bit about your personal journey to where you are right now in your career path?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, Laura. This is it's a real privilege. So where am I? So I currently teach in the biology department at John Abbott College, which is great fun. But, you know, like it took a while for me to get here. Again, I, you know, bachelor's of biology, a master's in parasitology, a PhD in ecosystem services, and a postdoc in evolutionary medicine to kind of figure out that I'm much more passionate about like teaching and sharing my passion than kind of doing the administrative paperwork that's maybe a little bit more of what a typical PI does these days. So yeah, so that's sort of where I'm at.
So you did research on parasitology for your master's degree at McGill. Could you tell us a bit about like what exactly is parasitology?
Sure. I mean, I'll you know, again, just to kind of frame it, I love horror movies. So that was like, you know, as a child, like horror movies, science fiction, this was like my jam, you know? And so the movie Alien, Aliens, these are movies that like I loved. And so when I realized that there are organisms on Earth that do basically exactly what these creatures do in these horror movies, it kind of blew my mind. So I was like, oh, I need to study this. And then I started reading a lot of scientific papers, and I read this amazing paper that showed that these parasites take over the behavior. They hijack their hosts and they cause their hosts to do crazy stuff. So then I quickly realized that that's what I needed to do with my career. So then I went to McGill, and because McGill is the only place in Canada that has an institute dedicated to parasitology. So parasites are organisms that live on or in their host and feed off of their host and use their host as kind of like a living kind of buffet / all-inclusive hotel. And there's some really fabulous, you know, molecular biology, physiology, pathology, evolutionary biology, kind of all of these really interesting questions can be generated when you're studying parasites, because the most hostile environment on Earth is inside a host because of the host immune system. So having to contend with that, all of those strategies are, you know, that have evolved are really, really interesting. So my journey to parasitology came from a passion of science fiction, and then just fabulous, just reading the literature and being sort of so impressed by what's happening. So I chose the institute. My master's degree kind of involved some parasitology and some biocontrol. Those few questions that the research lab that I was in was asking. So there was an element of manipulation, an element of biocontrol, where the parasites that I was working on was kind of selected to prevent another parasite from entering the host. Because like, if you're inside your all-inclusive hotel, you don't want anybody else to come in, right? So that was sort of the questions that I was asking during my master's at McGill.
Are there like any specific parasites that you studied and you really liked? Or?
Well, so I not like during my master's, it was pretty low. And like I worked with Schistosoma mansoni, which is, you know, causes 200 million infections worldwide annually. It's a debilitating parasite, or which causes a debilitating disease, but it's not a manipulator. Only during my PhD and my master's did I get to play with parasites that eventually manipulated their hosts. So that's really what I wanted, but I didn't have access to those models for my master's.
So I was lucky enough to have Simon as a teacher in biology. And I remember you showed us pictures of the parasites. So like, what are some countries that you visited?
Well, yeah, so again, like part of the nature of the gig is, especially if you're an ecologist, you get to travel a lot. You know, a lot of kind of, you know, the discipline that you end up choosing also impacts your, you know, where you go and what you do. So if you're a biochemist, a molecular biologist, you tend to be in a lab. if you're an ecologist or an evolutionary biologist, you can often are asked to go to the field and travel and to exotic locales. So I was able to travel kind of pretty much all over the world for my research and for some sampling. So, you know, in Ecuador, when we went to the Ecuadorian Amazon and we saw some amazing parasites there, and we saw, well, the Orthocordyceps. So those of you that like the TV show The Last of Us, this cordyceps parasite sort of that infected humans, well, this exists and infects arthropods, and it causes all these weird behavioral changes, eventually killing the host. So I saw a bunch of those in the Amazon, which was pretty awesome. And then, you know, I love the worms. There's horsehair worms that cause their host. So those are from the ones we studied were in southern France. And they cause crickets and grasshoppers and spiders and arthropods to commit suicide because this worm wants to reproduce in the water. So basically all these crickets committed suicide. So that's some other fancy ones. I mean, there's some gross ones that, you know, when you're in the Amazon, leishmaniasis is pretty nasty. You don't want to get that.
So, like, are you saying a zombie apocalypse is possible?
Well, I mean, everything is possible. Is it likely? No, because these parasites are very specific to their hosts. That, I mean, we've, you know, briefly talked a little bit about that earlier. Like, in order to survive in the most hostile environment, the host's immune system, parasites have to evolve for millions of years these strategies to deal with that. So for these really crazy parasites to attack humans, and we have probably the most complex immune system on any species just because of our global distribution, blah, 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 it would be really rough. I mean, we probably are more likely to have a bacterial or viral pathogen over a metazoan, a parasite that's multicellular.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah, we're good, we're good. Okay.
So then after your master's, you focus your doctorate research on community and spatial ecology at UDM. What specific ecological communities or ecosystems did your research focus on, and what did you choose them?
Well, that was interesting. Again, what brought me to that research lab was papers. So during my master's, I liked the system that I was working with, but it was small scale. I was in a small lab. It was very circumscribed. The field work was small scale. And I felt like I wanted bigger. You know, I felt like for my PhD, I need to tackle questions that are broader. And so I read this great paper by Jacques Bradat, who ended up being my PhD advisor, and he's a biocontrol guy, but he studied wasps. And these parasitoid wasps lay, I mean, most of you maybe don't know this, but the vast majority of wasps are tiny. They're not big. When they sting, they actually don't sting in the way that you think. Their stingers are an ovipositor, so they actually lay their eggs as they sting, and the stinger injects a virus and some cells that, you know, kind of take over the immune system of their host, cause a whole bunch of different things. So parasitoids are really cool and do some really weird stuff to their hosts. So Jacques Bodard was researching parasitoids, but the system that we were looking at was more looking at how farmland shapes, so the type of farm, you know, the type of agriculture, what plants are there, what, you know, proximity to roads, you know, what type of cattle, is it, you know, what, you know, are there forest habitats nearby? So the idea of looking at space, looking at the configuration of landscapes, the composition, and how that impacted whether or not we would find these parasitoids. Would these parasitoids target birds? Would the birds also be targeted by other ectoparasites? These are types of flies. Was a really fascinating question. So I kind of got into kind of this team just again through a paper, and then by, you know, and often the way it works, the supervisor offers you a, you know, different types of projects. And this one kind of, I thought was interesting because it was large scale. It was local. So I didn't have to go super far. At that point, I wanted to stick around still. and ask some really cool, like, learn how to use GIS, which is geographic information system. So I use satellite imaging. This was something that I'd never worked with. So yeah, it kind of hit a bunch of notes that I wanted to challenge myself with.
Okay, that's interesting. What are some of the key concepts in spatial ecology that are essential to, like, the research that you did?
Well, I mean, so spatial ecology kind of is like, it's, so it starts off, landscape ecology and spatial ecology are kind of one and the same. So when you think of communities and when you think of ecosystems, you know, we talk about what are the living organisms that are there, and ecosystems, we talk about, you know, what powers them, you know, what are the geochemical cycles. But landscape ecology looks at composition, structure, configuration. And this is something that's kind of, we tend to not realize how important that is. The idea of a matrix. When you look at a landscape and you start to look at the how things are arranged. So for instance, if you go out and you decide, I'm going to plant trees. Well, that might not have the impact that you might think. If you plant trees all in one patch, in one big forest, or what if you plant trees the same number in multiple small forests connected by natural corridors? That might give you more bang for your buck. So, you know, especially in a world where human activity is degrading landscapes and natural habitats and cutting them or shrinking them or partitioning them, the idea of composition or spatial configuration, composition, structure becomes really, really relevant. So that was kind of, that was the new part to my thinking when I was looking at these questions.
I remember in your class, you told us, like, when you build a road, it's like you separate two, you create like two different ecosystems.
That's it. Road is a barrier. Most animals hate roads, right? Yeah. They're thermally different than the habitat around them because they absorb and release a lot of heat. Yeah. So most animals can see in infrared. So this creates this massive opening, vulnerable barrier that they hate. So yeah, roads are really tricky. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, when I was in Alberta, I thought of you because they have like these things. Mm-hmm. It's like green bridge.
Green bridges. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we this comes from Europe because Europe, they've had to do this just because they're old. It's an older, you know, the old world. So in order to link their natural habitats, they've literally created green bridges. So these are bridges with like vegetation and forest to allow wildlife to cross the roads to create what's called connectivity or networks.
Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
So what methods or tools did you use to study like spatial patterns in ecological communities?
Well, software. I mean, this is, again, like, I mean, for you guys, I don't think this is a surprise, but biology absolutely is interconnected with computer science, with statistics. Yeah. So, you know, especially as an ecologist, as a landscape ecologist at that time, you know, you need really good software to be able to analyze your data. Because again, you're presented with so much data that in order for you to kind of look at patterns and trends, so for this was ArcGIS. I'd never used that before, so that's kind of the bread and butter of any, you know, of any type of landscape work, is you need to somehow digitize or quantify landscape. So ArcGIS allows you to do this from satellite imaging. And then, you know, once that was done, the big tools were, I mean, at the time, Python was not really the tool to use. It was relatively new. We were using R, statistical environment, just to analyze a lot of our work. So the actual technology is really simple. You need a computer. And then it's really software for an ecologist. Software is the best. So really quality statistics. You really need to know what to do when you're looking at data that is spatial, because you are collecting multiple samples from areas that are linked, so they're not independent. So often you violate a lot of the basic assumptions of a lot of the standard stats. If you're doing anything over multiple seasons, you have a temporal component. So you have spatial and temporal that you need to kind of figure out how to work with. So those were the two big kind of technological tools, and, you know, satellites, obviously, you know, for the mapping, but it was software.
Okay. Do you know if there are any like current trends or imaging areas in like the research that you did or anyone who's doing research on this kind of subject?
Well, that's a really good question. So I think like the trend with regards to landscape ecology and ecology as a whole is connectivity. So kind of looking at, and this is like, there's a really great group at McGill, Gonzalez lab, looking at biodiversity, looking at connectivity, how different habitats connect to each other. So these bridges, these natural bridges. So that's taking all of their basic understanding of landscape ecology and understanding how the composition of the landscape affects what species you find and how you can sustain those communities, and applying it into actual, like sitting down with the cities, sitting down with provincial and federal governments, planning natural corridors. So like City of Montreal, right, invested this huge natural corridor to the north of the city, which is huge in terms of maintaining species diversity and allowing them to move from one patch to another. So I think that's where really where things are going, because it's kind of it's a solution.
Yeah.
We're trying now, going from not just fundamental research, but application of that knowledge.
So after your PhD, you did a postdoc at the CNRS
yeah.
in France on evolutionary medicine. So what specific health issues or medical conditions did your research address, and what did you choose these areas?
So, I mean, these things are, you know, it's so funny because like my path is not planned, but planned. So during my PhD, looking at landscape stuff, I was still fascinated by parasitism. That kind of never went away. The model that I was studying was a parasite model. But again, I wanted to deepen my, like, instead of going big, I wanted to go really fundamental and understand the evolutionary mechanisms that allow parasites to evolve, or how have they evolved? I, again, the more I learned, the more I was puzzled by like what forces shape parasitism, what are the advantages, disadvantages, how parasites and hosts, like what's their shared trajectory? Like, is it simply a matter of antagonism, or do you eventually become symbiotic, where there's a lot of parasites that live in us that are now symbiotic, like the bacteria that live on us and in us? So I joined a research lab in France at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique. So the way France works is their system is subdivided. So if you are studying evolution, you are in Southern France, in Montpellier, that's the hub. So went there with Frédéric Thomas, who's basically the person in the field of parasitic manipulation. So I find it ended up working with questions relative to parasites that manipulate their host's behavior. So we started working on that a little bit. And then his mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and then my grandmother was diagnosed with breast cancer. So simultaneously, we both were faced with this de novo parasite, because fundamentally cancer operates a lot like a parasite that just evolves within you, right? It uses your resources, it's antagonistic to the needs of the host, but it's not to the advantage of the cancer to kill the host, because then the cancer also dies. So there's some really interesting questions about the evolution of cancer, about how cancer, you know, the journey or the evolutionary journey that tumors take over their lifetime, because tumors evolve. They're highly dynamic, shaped by evolution through the immune system and all these really interesting pressures. So our lab question shifted, you know, we did a 180 from parasitic manipulation to cancer. And that's where I really started to bring in my community and landscape ecology. We started asking questions about, you know, the cancer within its context, within its what's called a tumor microenvironment, a tumor ecosystem, tumor ecology, looking at individual cancer cells as individuals within a population, within a community that are evolving, that are fighting for resources, that are spreading, that, you know, dispersal, connectivity. So, you know, we started taking tissue biopsies and basically putting them on our GIS and mapping tissue architecture. So that was really cool. So that's kind of how I got to that, was again just kind of an internal passion, reading cool people, and then, you know, opportunities that present themselves and go with it. But you have to pivot.
Mm-hmm. What, do you think, like, we're going to find a cure to cancer someday?
I mean, that's a really good question in the sense of, I mean, some cancers, we have found cures, right? There are some cancers now that with the tools that we have, especially if they're caught early on, we definitely, you know. But again, what's beautiful about diversity and evolution is it fosters diversity. So again, no human being are the same. Everybody's different. Everybody's genetically different. And so the problem with that is every tumor is genetically different. Every cancer is unique. There are some patterns. So cancers that emerge in lung tissue have patterns, but they're still different because the environment is different. The host is different. The mutations are a little bit different. The context is a little bit different. So where I'm really hopeful of cures is personalized medicine through access to sequencing. The cheaper sequencing can be, the better able we're going to be to get a handle on personalized medicine, individual treatments tailored. That's where, you know, messenger RNA vaccine technology, I think, is going to be so great because we can have a much better opportunity to tailor vaccines that are target those surface proteins that are unique to patients. Yeah. Slowly getting there. So, and then there's, should we even get rid of the cancer? A lot of interesting research is looking at evolution or tweaking or giving drugs or treating cancers so that our body tolerates them. Part of the problem with whenever you give chemotherapy or you do things to cancer is you basically force them to evolve into usually more aggressive forms. We become a selection force. We become this antagonistic force that kills cancer cells, and the ones that survive are by nature able to deal with whatever treatment that we're giving, and they're usually more aggressive, more virulent. So if we can also understand the better plan out interventions instead of making cancers more aggressive, resistant to treatment, develop a strategy where we can keep the cancer in check, having your body just tolerate it, keep the cancer into a benign state or into a localized, that would be really good too. So there's a lot of different approaches here, right? But am I hopeful for a cure? Yes and no. I just, you know, we're definitely deepening our understanding. So it's really exciting.
What's like the evolutionary history of cancer? Like, did we always have cancer?
I mean, that's a really great question. And that's something that I didn't think about before I got to this. Like, everything gets cancers.
Yeah.
Plants get cancers. Anything that's multicellular gets cancer. Again, multicellularity is a miracle. Like, think about this. Like, at some point, cells that were bacterial and were living alone, or, you know, early eukaryotic cells or even eukaryotic cells started to cluster together and started to cooperate. And so when you start to cooperate and cluster together, you forego yourself, this one cell, reproduction. Other cells start reproducing. That, from an evolutionary perspective, is killer, because that's how fitness is measured. It's by reproductive success. So over time, you know, in order for metazoan multicellular organisms to actually be stable and live long, you have to evolve strategies that sanction cheaters, that sanction individual cells that go rogue, yeah, and become cancerous. Mm-hmm. So there's this enormous evolutionary journey that led to multicellular organisms that are long-lived, that have, you know, trillions of cells. You know, but still, there are still mutagens, there's still problems. Like, this innate need for these cells to reproduce, to go rogue, to not listen to the collective, is always there. So the second the policing mechanisms, the second the mechanisms that curtail this cheat are blocked, so by a mutation, by mutating certain genes that are tumor suppressing genes that are part of this suppressing, by epigenetic modification, even by like bad diet, right? By not exercising, stress, anything that attenuates the immune system, all of these kind of barriers will allow cancers to emerge. So there's this fabulous, yeah, there's this beautiful evolutionary story. And then there's, you know, the evolution of a single cancer within a host. which faces all of the same Darwinian forces. You know, populations of cancer cells evolve following very predictable Darwinian patterns. So there's this beautiful story there of evolution of cancer from, you know, the deep past to the present. So if we know this, then we start to ask the right questions and we start to tailor our approach appropriately.
Okay, you know how like larger organisms have more cells in their body, so shouldn't they be more likely to have cancer? But why is it that like whales and elephants don't?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that scientists have been kind of asking for a while. I mean, that question, it has been resolved. So this is called Peto's paradox. So Peto's paradox is, if you know your likelihood, cancer is probabilistic. So it's probabilistic to the number of cells that you have and the lifespan, right? Because every time a cell divides, mutations can occur. It increases the likelihood of the cell becoming cancerous. So long-lived, large organisms should be disproportionately more likely to get cancers. And, you know, like, again, we see this in humans. Humans that are smaller and shorter are less likely, statistically speaking, to develop cancers than humans that are taller and bigger. So we even see that within our own species. But why do things like whales or giant sharks or elephants, why don't they disproportionately get cancers? And this is the Peto paradox. Well, enter evolution and enter selection pressure. So the evolution of giganticism. Again, the elephant, the blue whales, these are not the only organisms that have evolved to be giants, right? Think of dinosaurs. So giganticism has some clear advantages, right? People don't eat you. You know, you can live for a very long time. You can probably move for long distances. And there are a lot of good reasons to be big. But again, the cost is too many cells. So in order to evolve to be giants, there's other things happening that we don't see. So we see the evolution of extra protective mechanisms. So there are sequences. So there's a gene called P53 that is a star. You know, it's the star of the tumor suppressor gene that codes for a tumor suppressor protein called P53. You know, very exciting. And so we now know that elephants and whales have extra copies of those genes. So they actually have mutations where they have genes that have been, or gene regions that have been completely duplicated. So they have extra copies of their protective genes. So not only do they make more of those proteins, that if by happenstance, if those proteins get turned off or there's a mutation, they have extra redundancy. So that now, that paradox has been resolved. We now know that this is what's happening at the molecular level.
Is there like a way to hijack that and include it into the human genome?
Sure. In the sense of like, these are definitely questions. So like the people that want to live forever, you know, like that guy in California there that wants to live forever. These are questions that, you know, he's definitely trying to do. Again, it's illegal to alter the genome of an embryo, right? So we don't alter zygote genomes. And that's really the only way that this would be sustainable, where we don't have a delivery mechanism for CRISPR technology or for gene editing technology that could target all of your cells, right, to duplicate this this gene sequence. So that's tricky. And, you know, P53 and these protective mechanisms is one of the many mechanisms. So there, you know, even if P53 is working, there's still tissue architecture, there's still a few other things that we need to think about. But I mean, who knows what the future holds?
I know you're also passionate about just evolution in general, yeah, not just cancer evolution. What are some like species that are similar to humans that went extinct, and why like did they go extinct?
Well, like think of all the members of our genus, right? Homo sapiens is the only member of the genus Homo that has survived. Everything else has gone. You know, all the other members of our genus have gone extinct: Homo neanderthalis, Homo silensis, and etc. Like, there's a whole bunch. So, you know, the question arises kind of like, why us? And we don't know. I mean, there's some really great stuff. I love this stuff, the anthropology of it all and the ancient genetics. So Pablo Sfante's work, which is, you know, amazing, and David Reich's work is super cool, looking at, you know, the secrets, you know, Neanderthal genes and Homo Denisova genes within our own genomes, and kind of thinking about those questions of what happened. So fundamentally, we don't know, but there's some fun hypotheses to think about. So what does Homo sapiens do really well? We coordinate, we communicate. And so, you know, there could be something about that our ancient ancestors, when we entered, you know, when we left Africa and we entered Europe and we entered, you know, the Western Europe and Eastern Europe and into Asia, and Homo sapiens confronted or interacted with other members of our genus. Why is it that we outcompeted, them, and, you know, we sometimes crossbred with them because we have genes. How else would we have Homo Neanderthal sequences within our own genomes? So there are definitely, you know, times where we crossbred. So there's some fun hypothesis from anthropologists about, like, our brains and our capacity to coordinate. And really, we think it's our culture and ability to communicate and coordinate our actions that seem to have been, like, a big thing. So that's what's fun, because evolution then starts linking with, like, brain, social behavior. There's some really fun stuff there.
Do you think there might have been, like, more superior human-like species that could have taking our place?
Well, I mean, those are really fun. I mean, I love science fiction and fantasy. So to me, that those are really fabulous questions. And, you know, people, there's a lot of, you know, like, you know, what do you call those? The you know, people look at pyramids and think of Atlantis and conspiracy theories around that. No, I mean, in the sense of, you know, other members of our genus and other, they've gone extinct, right? So, like, they have disappeared because of their context, because, you know, their genetic diversity wasn't, you know, and their phenotypic plasticity simply stated they were not well suited to their environments, and they slowly but surely could not produce enough descendants to sustain populations, and then they disappeared. So no, I mean, I do think that we kind of, I don't think that there's, like, hidden super, you know, evolved humans somewhere. Like, that's, I, you know, there's no evidence for that. You know, maybe if we find some cool skeleton somewhere, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. But so far, you know, this is it for us.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the intersection of ecology, evolution, and medicine?
Well, I mean, the intersection is holistic, right? The whole. So, I mean, in terms of medicine, health questions, I mean, we are, and this comes with math, this comes with comp sci, this comes with our ability to process really complex data. In order to understand disease, in order to understand pathology, in order to understand, you know, to give really good advice in terms of treatment options, you have to understand an individual's system, so the collective of cells and tissues and organs and organ systems, but you also have to understand where that individual fits within its context. So its work, its ecology. So all of these things come together. You know, we are also evolved species, so we come with our own evolutionary baggage. So to not look to the past to understand our anatomy, our physiology, but also not understand how our interventions can have an impact on our, you know, the evolution, you know, of microbes within us, blah blah blah. So I think, and I know moving forward, a lot of medicine is going towards looking at individuals within their context, within their community, right? A community approach to treatment. And sort of there's some really interesting things happening there, you know, especially in a world of COVID, especially in a world where now we know how disease spread is so also intricately linked to social context, right? So, like, areas that are more conservative are less likely to uptake or to take on, you know, vaccines and blah blah blah. So, like, there's a huge also social component that's part of the big kind of ecosystem of health. So yeah, I mean, all of these things are intricately connected. I mean, you cannot partition them. They're all part of the same package.
So So thank you, Simon, for being a guest on our podcast. And thank you, listeners, for listening to STEMcast.